I am now going to turn it over to Preetha, who will introduce our wonderful guest today. And so, Preetha, would you like to take it away, please?
Great. Thanks, Amit. I'm really excited to be having this conversation with my dear friend, Sujata Baliga, who I have, every interaction I have had with her, I've learned and grown immensely from every pearl that comes out of her mouth. And she's someone who leaves me always wanting more, and I hope you'll have that experience today. Sujata is the director of the Restorative Justice Project at the National Council on Crime and Delinquency in Oakland, where she helps communities implement restorative justice alternatives to juvenile detention and zero tolerance school discipline policies. She's also specifically dedicated to advancing restorative justice as a tool to end child sexual abuse and intrafamilial sexualized violence in the U.S. as well as South Asia. Her work is characterized by an equal dedication to victims and persons accused of crime. She's a former public defender herself and also a victim advocate. And she's been a frequent guest lecturer throughout the world at universities and conferences. She's been a guest on NPR's Talk of the Nation and the Today Show, and her work has been profiled in an extensive article in the New York Times Magazine. She speaks publicly and inside prisons about her personal experiences as a survivor of child sexual abuse and her own personal path to forgiveness. She is a graduate of Harvard College and the University of Pennsylvania, and she's also had some federal clerkships. And significantly for our audience, she's a longtime meditator, about 20 years, I think. And so I think, Sujata, where I'd love to start with you is you're one of the remarkable people whose work and external, your outer life flows so organically from your inner journey and your inner work. So maybe you could start with that and tell us how did you come to your work on the justice system and on helping victims of sexual abuse?
Sure. Thanks, Preetha. And I'm so pleased you're moderating today. It feels comfortable to be having sort of a chat with a friend in front of an audience. It's lovely. So a little bit about sort of how I ended up doing the work that I do today. So I grew up in rural Pennsylvania in the 1970s and 80s. We were the only immigrant family in our town and sort of the larger region there. And it was not an easy childhood. I was experiencing abuse in my home at the hands of my father. My father sexually abused me for as long as I can remember. It was challenging to be sort of a religious minority and sort of cultural minority in a small rural place. And so I was having a lot of sort of bullying experiences at school as well. And sort of just a lot of struggles personally. My father passed away when I was 16, which created a whole other set of struggles. And I think all of that suffering in some way catalyzed me to want to do something about it. And over the years, what that looked like was moving towards victim advocacy. So I became a victim advocate during and after college, working with battered women's shelters and on rape crisis hotlines and with sexually harmed children and women. And what I noticed at during those years is that while I was effective, I didn't like who I was personally. A lot of my work was fueled by, or all of my work maybe at that time, was fueled by my own unresolved traumas wanting to sort of undo my own childhood by quote-unquote fixing other people's lives. And really the anger was eating at me personally. I had migraines regularly, several times a week, blinding migraines, and really terrible stomach problems. I'm sure it was some sort of IBS thing. It was never really diagnosed despite going to countless doctors and going through so many procedures, and nothing could really solve it. I remember really resenting being told that it was something sort of psychosomatic. And while in retrospect, I don't think it was psychosomatic, it was all definitely happening. It was definitely what I realized caused by my unhappy state of being and my angry state of being. It also was sort of wreaking havoc on my friendships and my boyfriends and many other things at that time. It was interesting. I had followed one of the man I was dating at the time. I'd followed him to India for a year and was working, trying to help him start a program for the children of sex workers in Mumbai. That was the way I'd conceptualized at the time. And when I got there and tried to get involved in the project, I realized the degree to which these women and their children were basically slaves. And it was just too much trauma for me to handle. I hadn't worked out my own stuff, and I basically had a breakdown and realized that I needed to heal myself. I was just about to start law school. I was 23, 24 years old. I was just about to start law school, and I realized I had to sort of work out myself before I could possibly go to law school. I was not going to survive the sort of emotional and intellectual rigors of law school in the current state I was in. So I went backpacking. I landed in Dharamshala by myself and befriended a number of Tibetan families who I sort of was so engaged as a crisis counselor kind of person that I really would dig into stories with people about sort of how did you escape and what's the landscape of Tibet today for your people, and I really wanted to understand sort of people's trauma journeys and the suffering that they'd experienced. And I think that maybe it was a rare experience for them, and that a lot of people, I think, come to places like Dharamshala, which is where the Tibetan government in exile at that time was, and where His Holiness's offices still are. For more people come for more of a spiritual journey, I think. And so I came sort of on my trauma journey, which I think people appreciated to some degree, where I wasn't sort of making them sort of prisoners of Shangri-La in a sense. But what I noticed in my conversations with them was that they would shift from these stories, these heartbreaking stories, where people could cry and express anger, eventually towards some sort of just letting the subject matter go, and then a few minutes later be laughing and sharing happy stories, right? And I was never really able to make that transition. I sort of lived in the anger and the rage, and eventually somebody sort of had the courage to ask me through my sort of hard external way of presenting at that time. Said, "So what are you so angry about? What's going on with you?" Which was a wonderful question. And so I started to share sort of for the first time in my life with people outside my inner circle that, you know, my father had sexually abused me, and there was a lot of horror and shock from the people that I would share this with, and many of them would say, you know, you should ask His Holiness, how does forgiveness play a role in this? And I'd ask them, you know, how are you so happy? How can you be so happy given what you've been through? And the answer would often come back, we practice forgiveness. And so then the dialogue would then turn into what's the role of forgiveness in intrafamilial harm? And people would say, we should ask His Holiness. You should ask His Holiness. And I found this amusing. I'd say, he's busy. How do you ask the Dalai Lama a question like this? And so somebody said, write him a letter and drop it off at his monastery, and you'll get some sort of response. And so I followed the procedures. And I was a week later, I went back to see if there was a letter or something. And I was ushered all the way into the desk of His Holiness's private secretary, who said, His Holiness is, schedule has changed. He was supposed to be in Assam or something. Would you like to have a private audience with him on Wednesday, or Tuesday, something like a few days later? And so I had this unbelievable opportunity to have an hour with His Holiness. During that hour, the conversation started very much from the perspective of talking about gender-based violence and sexualized violence, and sort of, and then it shifted towards His Holiness sharing very deeply about his own path to forgiveness, and at some point, I said I was so moved by his own personal sharing of times earlier in his life when he had felt anger towards the Chinese, and what practices and work that he had done on himself to do this. And I could see in front of me this living embodiment of someone who had eschewed anger, let go of anger, but was still working on behalf of those who suffer without anger as the motivating force? And that had been my question in my letter to him. I was unable to write the words, "I was sexually abused by my father," et cetera. What I said was, "Anger is killing me, but it motivates my work. How do you work on behalf of abused and oppressed people without anger as the motivating force?" And so, I was seeing this. I was seeing someone clearly far more effective at achieving positive ends for others without anger, even in the face of unthinkable mass atrocity against his people and his nation and himself. Right. So how does he do this? And I said, I want to forgive my father. I want to follow this path. And the first question that came out of his mouth was, "Do you feel you have been angry long enough?" And I thought this was the most brilliant question I have been ever asked, especially about forgiveness, when there's so many people who would say to you, "Oh, you need to forgive," or "You need to forgive and forget," and it's very clear that when people are phrasing forgiveness as some freedom for you, that it's really about them wanting you to get over what's happening, where your natural, normal responses to unthinkable harm, right, that you've suffered. So His Holiness asked me this question, and it was a genuine question. I could feel how genuine that question was, and I actually took a moment to sit in silence with him and reflect on anger's diminishing returns on my life, on my personal life, on my relationships, on my boyfriend, on my family, on my effectiveness in the work, on my happiness. And after surveying the landscape of, the graveyards of what anger had left in my life, I said, "Yes, I'm ready. I'm ready." It served me to this point. It is a big part of why I was able to survive to this day. But here I am, ready to let it go. Yes, I want to. And so His Holiness gave me two very particular pieces of advice. The first one was to meditate. He said, "Your mind, this level of rage," and I was, even in that audience with him, I was extremely angry and describing the work that I did and really raging about it and very angry. And he said, a mind that's this rageful is just out of your own control, and so you need to meditate in order to rein it back in. The first piece of advice was to meditate. Really learn how to be the master of your own mind, right? And so I was like, okay, that one I can do, right? So great, I'll sign up for a meditation course. And then his second piece of advice was to in some way open my heart to those who have done me harm or who do harm. Open your heart to your enemies or those you perceive to be your enemies. And I started laughing. I was laughing out loud at him, saying, "That's crazy. I'm about to go to law school to be a prosecutor to lock all these abusers and batterers and child molesters up and put them behind bars." And he thought this was hilarious, So he pats my knee. He's like, okay, you just meditate." And so I immediately, after leaving him within the next few weeks, went and sat a 10-day Vipassana course, so Goenkaji-style Vipassana course. And it was the hardest and best thing I had ever done in my life. I think I couldn't hear your name. Maybe it's Mela or Bela from Berkeley. That body-based experience of feeling in my body where my anger resides, feeling when images and memories of the terrible things that had been done to me came to my mind, that Vipassana scanning, that body scanning, was incredibly powerful for me to really be able to dissect where in my body those memories live and what the physical sensations around those memories, sort of what they lead to in terms of like this endless loop of suffering that my mind goes into. So I think having done that, for the first 9 days you're doing, breath observation for 3 and then there's 6 more days of body scanning and really feeling embodied for the first time in my reactions to the things that had been done to me so many years ago, right? And also being able to be present in the present moment, realizing my body is reacting to things that aren't currently happening. Like, that was very powerful for me physically to feel, wow, I am having residual physical reactions to things that are not occurring in this beautiful meditation hall in Massachusetts, right? So then, sort of what flowed from that was the myth of Bhavana Day, the loving practice, loving kindness practice that they teach you the last day. I had a spontaneous sort of vision of one of the times in which my father molested me, that usually brought up experiences of rage and anger. And and I used to replay that memory sort of as a fantasy, as if I stabbed him to death instead of him being able to achieve what he was trying to achieve. Like I would imagine stabbing him to death instead. And I think that when I started doing that with that memory, that stabbing, adding the stabbing him to death thing, it's right about when my migraine started in my late teens. So instead, I just allowed the thing to happen as it happened. That doesn't mean that I condoned it. It doesn't mean that I thought it was okay, but rather that, you know, I love this quote about forgiveness. I've heard that forgiveness is giving up all hope of a better past, right? And so I just let the past be what it was. I just observed it for what it was. And so in this memory, rather than feeling the rage, I sort of felt my father dissolve into light. And that subtle sensation, that awareness in my own body of sort of that, just that lovely molecular flow that you can feel sometimes after long fits, sort of flowed out of me and into him, and he dissolved into light. And from that moment onwards, I have never felt any anger, rage, any of the things, feelings, desires for retribution, feelings for, you know, getting back at him, anything, all of these things, of course, being impossible now that he's passed. But I still carried all those desires, like as if I could bring him back from the dead so that I could punish him somehow. All of those needs were gone with regard to him. I'm not saying that I'm over anger, you know, when someone cuts me off in traffic sometimes, or when something, you know, when some atrocity is happening in the world, I'm not beyond anger. But I am beyond anger about that and about many other things. And I'm probably beyond the feeling of retribution as being useful, or even the desire for that coming up in me anymore. And so I went to started law school a couple weeks later, and I had no juice for being a prosecutor. I thought I should drop out. And so I went to my criminal law professor and I said, I think I'm dropping out. And he said, don't drop out. I didn't tell him why. I said, I came here to be a prosecutor. I have no interest in being a prosecutor. I came here to help battered women. I don't know how to do this now. And he said, you should think about being a defense attorney who defends women who kill their abusers. And I was like, well, that's brilliant. He didn't tell me at that time that one doesn't get to specialize in that right away, right? So I had to be a public defender for many years, defending even those folks who had done exactly what was done to me as a child. And I, you know, really feel like I gave them excellent representation and had a wonderful opportunity to be of service to folks who've done things that were done to me. And at the same time, the entire criminal legal system always felt not okay to me. There was a way in which it was so fundamentally binary, like it was us versus them, and it felt divisive, and that it wasn't a healing way. It wasn't what I had learned in my own life as my way of moving past terrible things that have happened. It couldn't be more different, really. I think of a court of law, and I think Susan Herman, the Trauma and Recovery, the author of Trauma and Recovery, says you couldn't create a better circumstance for bringing up traumatic stress than a court of law, right? So we really re-victimize victims, and we really, it's a damaging process for everyone who goes through it, almost everyone who goes through it. So I started to learn about, I kept in touch with His Holiness's office, and they suggested that I read this book on Tibetan justice called, The Tibetan System of Justice Prior to Chinese Occupation, called The Golden Yoke, Y-O-K-E. And it was a wonderful book describing many ideals that were there in the Tibetan law code about healing and victim-identified needs being attended to, and notions like atonement and reconciliation. And I thought, my goodness, how could we do some of that here? And a friend who had been saying these words for years, restorative justice, when I was describing this to her, she said, I've been telling you about this for years. Susan said, it's called restorative justice. And said, I'm sorry, I didn't understand. And I started going to restorative justice trainings and learned so much about this model that I work in today as what I think is the better way to address wrongdoing, even the most terrible forms of wrongdoing, when it's at all possible.
So I want to get to that in a second about
this better way,
but your story is so overwhelming and compelling. I just have to ask a follow-up. You talked about doing your first Vipassana sit, I guess, 20 years ago, right after you met His Holiness and before you went to law school, I guess between college and law school, right?
Yeah.
And you describe kind of the spontaneous experience you had on the 10th day, the Metta Bhavana portion of kind of forgiveness, of overcoming your anger. How did you keep that up? I mean, you know, it's one thing to have these magical moments and lightness. How did you, was it just kind of like gone forever, or is this something you had to kind of keep cultivating?
About my father and about the sexual abuse I endured, yes, it is gone forever. It was gone forever. That being said, you know, I kept doing 10-day sits, Preeta, so I don't know if it would have been gone forever if I hadn't kept doing sits. So every summer during law school, you know, whatever internship I had, I was like, I can't do it the whole summer. I have to go do this 10-day sit, you know, and that was sort of a prerequisite for choosing opportunities in my life, that there would have to be a way for me to do a 10-day sit often, you know, at least once a year during those years. And so, and I kept up my practice to some degree. It would have been wonderful if I could have done the whole 2 hours that are recommended every day. I never did that, especially during law school. I probably would have done better to have studied less and meditated more. But I did definitely do the 10-day sit every year, and I would try to fit some period of sitting practice, even if it's 15 minutes. Into every day during law school and since then, and I've just kept that up. So it's hard to know. I think I also just shifted sort of what I thought of as entertainment, you know, away from or what I would do with holidays and vacations, more towards Buddhist practice. And I started going to teachings with His Holiness that were, you know, anytime I could get to a teaching, you know, it's a 2 days, something is happening in Boston, I would just make that the priority instead of other things. And I just think constantly feeding your brain with certain ideas, your mind and your heart with certain ideas, and being in the presence of those, you know, who are embodying it, who have truly trained themselves in these ways, Thich Nhat Hanh, others, if I could just get in front of people who were walking it, who are living it, who embody it, then I would take the time to do those things. And sometimes sort of at the expense of my career or whatever, you know, I would be getting that advice all the time. Like, she's doing what? She's going where? She's giving up what to do what? You know, but I would, because for me, if I didn't, then I wasn't going to be able to do what I do.
Right. And I know it's a huge part of your ongoing life, the meditation and stuff, which we'll get to in a second. But let's turn to the criminal justice system. You talked about kind of how the current system re-victimizes victims, how it's kind of the antithesis of the kind of recovery and healing that you yourself experienced. Can you describe to us kind of a couple things, and I'll let you address this in whatever way you feel like addressing it, kind of what is the ideal criminal justice system, what is wrong with the current one, and how does restorative justice, and how does it fix it to some degree?
Mm-hmm. So as a restorative justice practitioner, so I have very, very concrete ideas that I take entirely from Howard Zaire, who is known as the grandfather of restorative justice and my mentor in this work. And he did this brilliant thing where he just really called us to a paradigm shift. In our current system of justice, particularly with regard to criminal harm, we ask a specific set of questions when we're confronted with harm, right? It's what law was broken, who broke it, and how do we punish them? And the paradigm shift that restorative justice calls us to is a very different set of questions. It starts with who is harmed, what do they need, and whose obligation is it to meet those needs, right? So it's you know, the primary focus is on the crime victim, or the initial focus is how the crime victim defines the harm themselves, right? And that is inherently incredibly empowering. And so to me, an ideal justice system would be attendant to those three questions. And it would be a problem-solving and a healing system rather than a punitive system. And what's broken with our current system is that it is driven by punitiveness, and we know that doesn't work. Like, our recidivism rates are, you know, reoffense rates are through the roof, right? In the juvenile justice context, it looks like if we never caught kids in the first place, they'd be less likely to reoffend than most of the vast majority of the juvenile justice interventions that we give them. That in fact, the processes themselves are what we call criminogenic, that the juvenile justice system itself increases the amount of juvenile harm that will flow from the kids that get in contact with that system.
Yeah,
so
some people say I had to go to jail to become a criminal.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So what would it look like? So when I think about when you're a kid and you throw a baseball through your neighbor's window, and if you're so lucky to have the kind of parents who would take you by the ear to your neighbor, have you apologize, find out how much it costs, and if you're so lucky to have an allowance, redact it, you know, until you have paid them back for how they paid to have that window repaired, right? You've learned something and you've redeemed yourself, right? And the same thing with, you know, I say this and people remember that moment when they got busted for shoplifting as a kid and their mother dragged them back to the store clerk to give the lipstick back, look the person in the eye, apologize, and, you know, whatever it is, you know, it's those are wake-up moments for us. And I think our justice system should be about those things. And I think that would cause the moral change within us. It would be driven by notions of empathy, compassion, repair, atonement, these types of things. And that really is what restorative justice is about. And number one thing, relationship. So we are in relationship with the people we harm, whether we created that relationship when we mugged a stranger or whether or not that relationship was pre-existing as it is with most child sexual abuse cases, right? We are in relationship with those people. What does it mean to heal that relationship is the way, you know, the field of restorative justice flows from many different ancient indigenous paths, whether it be the Maori in New Zealand or you know, Navajo peacemaking. We gain so much from these indigenous wisdoms about what justice looks like. And they don't bifurcate out justice as a different thing. Everything is addressed from the perspective of how are we in right relation with the earth and with each other. And, you know, I believe that we could have a justice system that attends to those same questions and concerns. And so that really, in a very brief nutshell, is what restorative justice is and what an ideal justice system would look like to me. That doesn't mean that there would never be incarceration. And I think about a couple, and literally a couple of the people I have represented in my life who are not safe for us and others, for themselves, really, to be out and about in the world. And there might be some period of confinement that is required in order to help people readjust to their best selves. But that confinement would look really different than the way we do confinement today, right? It would be a mental health-based right. model, and it would be an opportunity for people to change themselves,
right.
And maybe meditation, et cetera, would all be a part of that.
Right. So you say that you'd like to see the justice system move from one of punishment to healing. In your experience, what is it that people, communities, as well as perpetrators, need to heal? Is it truth finding? What is it?
Yeah, truth is huge, right? It's probably why I named my kid Sethia. I'm sort of obsessed with it, and I think many many child sexual abuse survivors are quite interested in this truth, right? We have to tell the truth, which truth has to be uncovered. You know, and truth is really what's gorgeous about the restorative justice processes when they're done well, right? Are happening in a way. In the programs that I help start, we have this thing that we call the reverse Miranda rule, and we get prosecutors from the county to sign this thing. Nothing that's said in a restorative justice process can ever be used in a court of law, right? When I was a public defender, you know, I never really wanted to know the whole truth about my client's case. I mean, I did, but then it put me in this awkward position where I wouldn't want them to testify if they wanted to testify because I wouldn't want them to perjure themselves, right? We have a system that minimizes truth-telling right now because the stakes are so high for telling the truth, right? But what crime victims really want are answers to questions like, why did you pick me? And, you know, what were my daughter's last words? And, you know, where's her body? I mean, these are things that no one in their right mind, if they've got the answers to these questions, would answer, honestly. But what if the response was, we're going to move forward in a positive way and heal this and help you never do this again, right? Instead of, we're going to lock you up for the rest of your life or kill you, who's going to tell the truth under those circumstances? So with the reverse Miranda rule, you know, a person who's, you know, I get to sit down with a young person and say, and I train other people to do this too, like, how do you, you know, how do you get a young person to tell the truth and say, this is not about punishment. We just want to help you make it right. You know, we're going to help you make this right. So what's going on? You know, nothing you say, I'm going to tell the cops, nothing you say, I'm going to tell the DA. It's not going to come out in court. Tell me what's going on with you. Tell me what happened. And working with that young person until they can, so the truth can come out. And then prepping them to tell that truth in a way that is palatable, that is what the crime victim wants to hear when we finally bring them together. So I don't know if that answered your question, Preeta, but that truth-telling piece is so critical. It really gets at what people are most often asking for. What do all of these people need? You know, what's interesting is that all the parties in any given case in any community, you know, we say we hold these three in sort of equal compassion in our hearts, the folks who do the harm, the folks who've been harmed, and the communities that they come from. And every situation is unique and different. I mean, this is what's radically different from our sort of cookie-cutter approach to justice in America, you know, that we have these, like, we try to move towards uniformity and sentencing, et cetera, which has its value because if we didn't have that approach, then we know that the racial disparities in our justice system would be even worse, right? But if we're asking communities and people to solve problems in this more compassionate way, and where most harm in America is actually intra-community, right? It's folks harming their own communities and their own families. We're not going to have to worry so much about that sort of stuff, right? So,
get the community involved in the healing, right?
Yeah, when we get the community involved in the healing journey, you know, we can get really gorgeous, different, tailored outcomes in every case. And it's, you know, some kids are asked to paint an oil painting for a crime victim. Some kids are asked to rebuild a fence that they burnt down and work with a carpenter to do that. Some, you know, different people, you know, I worked on a homicide case where the outcome was that the crime victim, the young man, was going to have to serve time for having killed his fiance. And in addition, they wanted him to, but it was a shortened sentence of 20 years instead of the death penalty or mandatory life. And during those 20 years, he's agreed to learn all about teen dating violence, start restorative justice programs inside his prison, speak publicly, if he's allowed, in shackles at high school, about taking his girlfriend's life as a part of, you know, Teen Dating Violence Week. I mean, this is really remarkable stuff that the crime victims were part of deciding with him about what it needed to look like for this to be made right. So it's literally different in every case.
Yeah, there's so much I want to ask you about this, but I'm mindful of our time, and I want to leave it open for questions. But there's two things I just really want to cover with you. One, I know you're doing a lot of work with sexual abuse in the South Asian community. I'd love to hear a little bit about that, and then I really would love to hear you talk about, you know, as a participant in a criminal justice system, you're surrounded by such, you know, muck, so to speak, day. You have to kind of put your armor on and deal with kind of unspeakable agony and pain every single day. And how do you keep yourself grounded in your values? How do you keep yourself grounded in your work? And to go back to the question you asked the Dalai Lama, you know, how do you do this without being motivated by anger?
Mm-hmm. Well, I answer that one first. You know, so I just have a set of practices that I try to do as much as possible. One is Thong Len, you know, this notion of giving and taking. And I'd ask folks to look it up, T-O-N-G-L-E-N, but it really is just breathing in, you know, the suffering that I see in front of me and breathing out sort of my relative calm or my relative happiness or my love towards them, you know, whether or not there's somebody insulting me in front of me, you know, in some heated meeting in some, you know, criminal justice context, or whether or not it's when, you know, a kid is really enraged at me that they have to do this diversion program at all and you know, whatever it is. So that practice of Thonglen is critical for my sanity and my effectiveness in the work. The other thing is I read the 8 verses of thought transformation every morning. And that really, again, just trying to start my day with that thinking, the verses of thought transformation. And the other is just to really, yeah, keep up with that sitting practice and whatever it is, whatever's coming at me, starting with just the breath, return to the breath. I just return to the breath over and over and over again before I act, before I respond, especially when I feel in my body, you know, I know where in my body I feel that anger starting to rise up in my face, in my arms. You know, everyone has their place where they can identify maybe in your bodies where it is that you feel that heat starting to rise. And so I breathe into those places and then I sit with my breath, even if it's just one breath before responding. So that's I just have a few techniques like that. The child sexual abuse work in the South Asian community is brand new. I'm super excited about it. It's the circle processes of the basic peacemaking process, you know, can be used to answer those questions. Who is harmed? What do they need? And whose obligation is it to meet those needs? You could do that with the person who's done the harm and the person who's experienced the harm, or you could just bring a group of survivors together and sit in circle and do peacemaking process. And so what I've been doing is sitting down with a group of adult survivors of child sexual abuse of South Asian descent. And we are doing what has never been done before, really, which is just to share our stories. And we're Hindu and Muslim and Buddhist and from different countries from across South Asia. And we're just starting to identify answers to those questions. How was I harmed? What do I need? Whose obligation is it to meet those needs? Interestingly, no one has said that they would like to see their abuser incarcerated. People have said they've needed a lot of other things. You know, but sometimes we start with meditation and we end with meditation in those groups as well. And it's just a moment of silence being together and then sharing our stories and holding each other's stories in compassion and finding commonality in our journeys has been very powerful. So, you know, in India, we have a pandemic of sexual harm there. And I really, you know, I know Preeta, you know, I think of this as a transgenerational trauma that is being transmitted. And we need to be thinking about this rate of child sexual abuse, which the Indian government says is over 50%, 53% of Indian children are sexually abused. Over half of them are boys. That is a very heavy number to hold. And our solution can't be, you could pave the nation from Kashmir to Kanyakumari with prisons, and we would not have enough space to lock up everyone who's doing this harm. And as we know from America, our failed experiment in mass incarceration is not an example to be followed. So what would it look like for us to start to come to these problems with a healing solution, with a repair-based solution, with a how do we end child sexual abuse solution, which is as concerned with helping those who do the harm stop doing it as for their own moral and personal healing journeys, as we are with crime victims. I think we need to hold all of those things in our work. So this is the very beginning, and we're really excited about my coworker Nuri and I. Nuri and I are really excited about what the future could look like if we just start to examine these questions with an open heart.
It's funny, when you first went to Dharamsala and you said you met the Tibetan community in exile, I remember you saying once that they, when you told them your story of anger, they kind of said, oh, well, that doesn't happen in our communities. Are you hearing that now from the South Asian community, both in the U.S. and in South Asia? Do you hear, like...
No. No, Preetha, I don't. Pretty much everybody says, yes, we know this is a pandemic in our community, but what do you do about it? No, the Tibetan, I've never heard people say that other than that. Well, no, everybody says that doesn't happen in our community to some degree. Or what it is among South Asians, I hear people say, that doesn't happen in our family. We know that happens, but that happens in bad families. And I'd like to say, you know, that happened in my family, who, you know, is often seen as one of the good families, right? Like, when you think about sort of our educational background, our privilege, our caste, all that stuff, you know, it happened in my family, it happened with educated, et cetera. It happens in every community. So, but it is a particularly alarming number. And I don't know whether or not it's higher. It's one in the United States, one in four girls and one in six boys are sexually abused. That's the largest form, that is the largest form of harm that children experience in the country. But those numbers are way higher than gun violence and abductions and bullying. It's the number one form of harm children experience in the United States. And I think that it is underreported in the United States because the legal consequences of child protection and incarceration are so much greater in the United States. Immigration consequences so much greater in the United States. In India, it's a problem that they're ignoring it, or it's not being prosecuted. It's not, right? But because it is not, because child protection isn't going to come take your kids away at the same rate that it happens here, then I think people were much more comfortable telling these government authorities, who interviewed tens of thousands of families across India and children, to tell the truth, because you can say that without fear of consequences. And that's problematic, and also lets you get a better sense of what's happening. So I don't know that India has more sexual abuse than the United States, but and in some ways, because we're just starting to unpack it in South Asia, what should be the response to sexualized harm that would actually solve the problem? I think that there's some openings there that would be exciting to explore.
Wow. And, you know, I know you're in such high demand as a speaker, as a healer, as a community, someone helping communities heal themselves. You could spend 24 hours a day just running around the world helping victims, helping communities. How do you prioritize your work, and how do you take care of yourself?
But, you know, I know you know that you love this quote, too, by Anne Lamott, which is, lighthouses don't go running around the island looking for boats to save. They just stand there shining. And that I try to remind myself that I have an inbox full of 6,800 unanswered emails, right? Many of them are from child sexual abuse survivors. Many of them are from people saying, my child was locked up for a crime he didn't commit and he's being beaten. And it's, so, I mean, they are heartbreaking emails. And I have an 8-year-old child that I have to make the number one priority in my life. And I have an elderly dog who is not old for who's not long for this world, and a partner, family that, you know, I need to also be present for. So a part of it is self-forgiveness, really, about I'm not a Buddha. I'm not fully enlightened. I can't manifest in multiple dimensions and realities simultaneously. Maybe YouTube hits on my talks can help move me in that direction. But I can't. I literally can't. And so there's a certain point at which, if I don't centralize my own healing journey, if I don't take that time in the morning to sit, if I don't take that time to do my child's homework with him in the evening, I'm not going to be bringing my best to those. I'm going to be writing bad responses to those emails. And just hoping and being able to apologize when I respond later. I'm so sorry you invited me to give this talk and it was last month, and writing apology emails and saying I'm really limited and I'm so sorry is really freeing for me to just be able to say I can't is really good. And I hope to be able to be of benefit to you in some other way in the future, if that's possible.
Yeah, and together with that Annie Lamott quote, I know that you and I have talked about kind of Vivekananda's views about how at the end of the day, you know, we're not saving the world, and it's just keeping that sense of humility.
Absolutely.
You said to me, like, you know, we should, every question about, you know, what work we choose to do is this advancing our own healing journey? Because at the end of the day, that's what we're on Earth for.
That's exactly right. I mean, all I can do is continue to work on myself. And I don't actually have any, that I love that Karma Yoga text that Vivekananda's sort of notion that it's folly to think that we are actually doing anything, right? And we really don't know. And I think about this huge cosmic interdependent web and the karmic web of the universe, whether or not my keeping, you know, my healing and helping other people heal in this context is really, it might create some chain of events that causes harm. Who knows? All I can do is work on myself and my intentions. My intentions every day in every single thing I do. That's all I can continue to work on. And the ripple effects really flow from me out to my kid, my family, to other people I interact with, my coworkers, hopefully, that if I can show up as me every day in the work that I do, that can be the best me that I can be, then that's going to be a benefit, hopefully.
Great. Amit, should we open
Yes, up? Absolutely. Sujatha, it's just incredible hearing you share so deeply and so personally and so very insightful. And Preetha, you're doing just a masterful job of this. What I wanted to do was just open up the phone lines for our callers, so that way if they had a question for you or just wanted to share a reflection, they're able. And so for those of you that are on the call that have a question for Sujatha, please push *6, and that way you can be entered into the queue and to ask her a question. And it looks like we already have one caller.
Hi, Sujatha. This is Vinya calling in from Berkeley. I want to thank you so much for being part of our call today. Every share, every insight has been so incredibly helpful, and I just bow to you for your courage and for your honesty with us. Thank you so much for doing that. My question is, I work with children who are just short of going into the juvenile system, children who are very angry, who've been abused at home, who go through a lot of violence every day, and they bring all of this anger to the school system. And it's a very tricky situation right now. I'm supporting a school site where the staff are just completely burnt out. And they're doing the best they can. The students are, you know, there's just so much of anger. And we don't really have a well-thought-out, it sounds very behavior management system, so to speak. And I was thinking it would be so great to incorporate some restorative justice principles. So my question is, are you aware of any curriculum or, you know, an easy-to-use kind of resource where they can get some help? Or any resource at all with restorative justice that they'll be able to use in the school?
In the schools, you know, I can't say enough good stuff about somebody who's local. If you're in Berkeley, California, to Rita Alfred, also goes by Ranjitam, and she works at the Restorative Justice Training Institute, and she does amazing work. So if you just Google Restorative Justice Training Institute, she trains schools in this work, and one of the most important things she does is she encourages schools, when they are doing restorative justice transformations, to start the circle process with staff and only the grown-ups, and that the grown-ups are learning to sit in circle and listen and do deep listening and do the type of sharing and conflict resolution amongst themselves first, and building notions of relationship and amongst themselves. And that just sort of flows really naturally into the kids when you take it from the adult setting. The principals, the teachers, the staff start to embody this restorative way of being really in good relationship, that when you then take it to the kids, it feels hard to put it off for a year before we take it to the kids and we sort of see the kids as the problem. But once the grown-ups do it, children really vibe with kids really vibe with what grown-ups around them are expressing in being. And so Rita's really brilliant at that kind of work. So I would say it's Rita Ranjitam Alfred, Restorative Justice Training Institute, for schools related stuff. And she's right here.
That's great. And I just want to thank you again. I think the whole meditation part that you spoke about and how it helped you, it's so affirming. And I'm going to do my 1 hour sit right after this call. Thank you so
Yay.
Much.
Hi, my name is Anjali, and I'm calling from Chicago. And
Hi, Anjali.
Jeff, I really wanted to thank you. You had such a compelling story. And my question, actually, I have two of them. My first question is, do you really believe that all people can be rehabilitated? And, you know, you work with younger people, and I just don't know if that's a large part of why you see encouraging results. And, you know, what are your thoughts about, you know, just the concept that maybe some people are beyond that, or as you grow into adulthood, like maybe your father, that, you know, is there, you know, still a possibility for rehabilitation? So that was the first question. And the second question I have is, how do you forgive repeated wrongdoing without feeling like you're enabling it and not kind of giving yourself a chance to be taken advantage of by the wrongdoer? And, I mean, there's really extreme acts like sexual abuse, but even in a more mundane setting, whether it's you know, just your family members or somebody that you can't necessarily extract yourself or just purge yourself, it's your family, it's a loved one and someone you care about, but maybe somebody who, for whatever reason, you think there's repeated wrongdoing or disrespect or things like that. How does somebody deal with that effectively, and how do you forgive that when it's just maybe a very present thing?
Great, wonderful questions. So can all people be sort of rehabilitated, or can all people sort of become their best selves? No. Yes. So some folks have serious physiological harm to their brains, right? It's a teeny tiny percentage of those that we currently have behind bars. And teeny tiny. And again, to my mind, the question isn't about whether or not they can be rehabilitated, but what is the most compassionate and effective way of addressing their behavior, instead of looking at them from the perspective, this is a throwaway person, let's lock them up forever, right? But I think the vast majority of people, and definitely adults, and to be frank, my preference isn't to work with children. I feel like there's grown-ups get it better. Grown-ups have lived experience and have been on the receiving end of unbelievable harm. I do forgiveness circles inside prisons with adults, with guys who are in for life. I go inside all the time and spend lots of time with guys inside jails and prisons, and women inside jails, and who've done really unthinkably terrible things, and really absolutely believe in sometimes more about them than the rest of us who walk around these unthinking lives on the outside about their capacity to change. The question is, what kind of things are we offering people to do that change? We all need tools. I need tools. I needed Vipassana. I needed therapy. I needed years and years and years of therapy, right? I needed all that to become who I am today. And if we offer that same stuff to the folks we lock up, I absolutely believe the vast, vast majority of them would make the kinds of transformation that they would need to make in themselves to come out on the outside and be amongst us as wonderful parts of our community. But we're not doing that right now. So between now and then, we have to figure out what to do. In terms of repeated wrongdoing, what a challenging question, right? I mean, when you're on the, and it's even more than the big thing. Sometimes those constant repeated slights by the coworker, or the, you know, or the, whatever it is, the neighbor, the daily small, the thousand, you know, thousand paper cuts, really. The death to our compassion by the thousand paper cuts is sometimes the hardest thing to do. That's definitely where I need my most amount of work. And what does forgiveness look like in that context? You know, one of the things I try to look at most in those situations is self-forgiveness, forgiving myself for the frustration and anger that I feel, starting with that and sort of centering myself in where my disappointments with myself are, and why am I bothered by this little thing that my mother says over and over? What am I, you know? So working with that first. And then secondly, in terms of repeated wrongdoing, condoning it, letting people off the hook. So, when I think about the Dalai Lama, he both said that he forgives the Chinese for what they have done, right? And he's not in Tibet. He's not in relationships. So, like, there are people who I don't have in my life. I hold them in my heart with love and compassion, but I am not in close relationship with very few people who are really damaging to me. And it's not doing, allowing myself to be the continued continued object of their harming behavior is not of benefit to me or them, right? So it doesn't mean that you stay with your abuser. It doesn't mean you stay with that girlfriend or boyfriend who does constant harm to you. Really, the most compassionate act for both of you might be to make that break. Even when those people, this is really hard, and I think it's really hard for South Asians in particular, even when those people are family members, even when those people are, you know, that we may need to separate ourselves, and that can be done out of a place of compassion. And the forgiveness isn't letting people off the hook for their behavior. For me, the forgiveness is simply letting go of anger, hatred, right to retribution, revenge, that I carry in my heart. So I don't need to be angry at you anymore, but our continued being together may not be of greatest benefit to both of us, right, or to the work that we both have to do in this lifetime. I wish you well. I pray for you. I pray for myself in relationship to how I feel about you. But that's not what my forgiveness is about. It's not about continuing to subject myself to stuff that's not okay. That's for the big, big stuff, right?
Great. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. And so, Jabba, we have a question from someone over email from Patrick. And he says, you know, I've suffered what I could call unforgivable acts as a child. I then grew up, joined the Marines, went to war, and did things I deeply regret. And then after the military, I did things in my life that have hurt others deeply. So I've struggled to forgive those who have harmed me and struggled to forgive myself for the ways in which I've harmed others. And I'm more than just a victim of violence. I'm also a perpetrator. Mm-hmm. And so in some ways, it's easier to forgive those who have harmed me than it is myself. And I guess, you know, just wanted to, you know, Patrick wanted to hear just sort of your thoughts on that.
Mm-hmm. What a beautiful question. And I just really appreciate the transparency, the willingness to share that. I think we've all done harm and we've all done good. And if we believe in rebirth, then we've all definitely done unthinkable harm, because here we still are in this wheel of samsara, right? Coming back over and over to work this stuff out. So a part of it is for me sitting with that feeling and just not feeling it so personally as like I did these terrible things in this lifetime. And I have done some pretty awful things in this lifetime too. And so self-forgiveness, I think, is just such a critical, critical piece. I think it's the starting place. So when I do these practices like Thong Lin and whatever, sometimes I imagine the child that I was that received harm and do Thong Lin for me, in a sense, in that way, or the little child that still lives inside myself. I think that's really important. Another thing in that particular, holding those two truths about ourselves, that we are capable of doing good and bad, that we have done harm, and that we do really wonderful acts of kindness as well, is a poem by Thich Nhat Hanh called Please Call Me By My True Name. Patrick, I really hope you'll read that poem, and maybe it should be a daily practice, you know, to just wake up and read that poem or read it before you go to bed. There's a way in which that poem, Please Call Me By My True Name, you can just Google it, really allows us to hold. There's this amazing passage where he's talking about a child who throws herself into the ocean after being raped, a Vietnamese child throwing herself into the ocean after being raped by a sea pirate, a refugee child. And he says something like, I am that child who, after being raped by a sea pirate, throws myself into the ocean. And he says, and I am that pirate, right? And it's just, whose heart is incapable of seeing right now. Like, and so we hold these two pieces of ourselves with equal compassion. I think that that's such an important piece of the work to be able to hold ourselves in the worst things we've done in compassion, and to really do the deep dives, either through therapy or meditation or whatever, about where did my harmful behavior come from, without letting ourselves off the hook for it, right? But examining the roots of it and taking compassion into the practice all along that way.
Beautiful. We have a long string of callers who have questions for you, so I'm just going to go to our next caller.
Hi, Sujatha. This is Amita Martin. Actually, I'm Preeta's sister, and you are just very inspiring, and I just can't even tell you how inspiring your talk was today. Going a little bit more into forgiveness and the Vipassana and the meditation, I do believe, like with time and with meditating, that the anger does start to release and you start letting that go. But at what point does the hurt start going away? There's a difference between being able to not be as angry about a situation, but then also not feeling the hurt that's associated with that.
Wow. I don't know. I think it varies from person to person. Thanks for your question and your honesty. It is so true. Sometimes they're just layers. It's like an onion. Everything is an unbelievable onion. Where there's anger, there's pain. There's anger, there's pain. And you know, I've heard different theories about whether or not anger is just masking our pain, or pain is just masking our anger. I tend to think anger is masking our pain, and so that when we reduce the anger, then there's the next layer under it is pain about the things that we've suffered, right? And then under that pain, there may be something else, right? So I love this description that Pema Chodron has about meditation. We think it's going to be this panacea. And then what happens is we've got these raging waters and we still the waters, and then we look down into the water and what we see is the tire and the rusting cans and the skeleton. Like, meditation doesn't remove those things, right? It just lets us see what's there. And then as we continue to do the practice, we understand how to hold the truths of those things that are in our past, right? What I can say now is today, I don't feel either anger or pain about the sexual abuse I endured, right? I don't know. I think that the anger left first, and then, yes, and then the pain left second, shortly thereafter, and, you know, within a couple of years, probably. And I think about, but I also think that there's people who harmed me, and what I like to do is think of them like as having left a hole in my heart, you know. So and I name those holes in my heart. And so there's a so-and-so shaped hole in my heart about someone who's no longer in my life, who I still care about quite deeply. And what it is I've come to love that hole and what that hole teaches me. So it's not that the things didn't happen, or that space where there could be pain filled in isn't going to always be there. But that person who's no longer in my life, right, this ex-boyfriend that I cared about quite deeply, there's a hole in my heart that's shaped like him. And I think about that hole all the time. Not all the time. Sometimes it pops into my mind, but it doesn't cause pain anymore. It's something that I've come to look at as a piece of the journey that I've been on in this lifetime, and things that I have to learn from. And I try to fill that space with wishing him well now. But That one took a long time.
Thank you. Oh. Thank you for your question, Anita.
You know, while we're waiting for that caller to come on, just one other thought I wanted to add to the last question, which was that I loved what somebody had said when they called it about the person behind the act is a message. And that's a hard one to think. It's hard to think of my father as just being a message in a sense. And in some ways that almost takes away his responsibility for what he needed to have done differently, and he did need to do that differently. But as I sit here all these years later, there's nothing I can do about that. And sort of rethinking, what do I have to learn from what's happened, I think really helped. So I really liked that person behind the act as a message.
Thank you. Oh. Thank you for your question, Anita.
Hi, Sujata. If I really wish I could give you a deep hug now.
Oh.
thank you so much. Gratitude. Thank you so much. So, yeah, I have myself been through sexual abuse, and in that moment, I could relate to the poem that Thich Nhat Hanh you were talking about, that you know I just wanted to fall into that. Into the well that they had in their house. That was my right then. That was my thought. So, but of course, having transformed it slowly over a period of time, like what you were saying, there's so much to learn from it. There is so much potential for transformation coming from that. And what can I do with that experience? You know, how can I help people that I see have gone through the same thing that I have gone through? You know, those are the thoughts that come to me and recently I was watching this movie called The Railway Man, and in that it's the same thing. It's like it was like a forgiveness one-on-one for me, where he meets his perpetrator and talks to him and asks him, see, this is what you've done to me. Like, it's a refugee situation where the other person has put him through a lot of torturous acts. And so he talks to him. He goes back and talks to him and says, you have done this to me. And he puts him through the same thing, you know, just to give him a feeling of what he went through. And that really threw a lot of light for me on, you know, what forgiveness could mean. It's just not a passive thing in your mind that, you know, okay, I forgive you and that's it. But it's a two-way thing, right? That's where it's very holistic and a wholesome thing happens there, transformation from both sides. So, yeah, what are your thoughts on that?
I think that's a challenge for me, the two-way street, because sometimes I don't, my personal feeling, people vary on this. My personal feeling is that forgiveness doesn't require anything from the person being forgiven. Like, the forgiveness is a gift I've given myself. So my father passed away before I was ever able to say everything I would like to say to him if he were alive today, right?
Right.
But so for me, it was just my own intra-individual, inside myself, relinquishment of my anger, my hatred, my retribution, my desires for retribution, my revenge desires towards him. That for me is freeing myself. For me, there's another incredible layer that can occur through a direct dialogue with the person that you, whether through letter, through whatever, with the person that has done that harm. And if those opportunities arise, right, from my mind, it's the same with all confrontations that, you know, people do. You know, I ask us to ask ourselves, what are we expecting to receive from this? Am I doing this for me? Am I doing this because I need to hear X and Y and Z from that person? What will happen for me if I do not hear those things? To really prepare myself for that conversation in a way that my expectations are about my journey and me and not about what I'm going to hear back from that person.
Okay.
That being said, sort of in restorative justice processes, restorative justice doesn't require forgiveness as a prerequisite or an outcome. But I see it happen quite a bit because I think when we create situations where people can take responsibility, genuinely apologize, and offer something to repair the harm, that's like sort of the perfect cauldron for cooking up some forgiveness, right? But it's, again, never expected. It's never required. It's not a part of the model. But when it happens under those circumstances, I think there's something very beautiful about it.
Yeah. Beautiful. Thank you.
Hi, this is Mish in New York City. I'm a member of Kind Spring. First, thank you so much for sharing your amazing, inspiring life. I'll quickly say what I have to say. I wanted to offer up a possible resource for those who work with at-risk youth. It's a nonprofit called Arise Foundation. They teach life skills to at-risk youth, and they also offer staff training and offer, I think it's free, I'm not sure, a multitude of materials, and God bless you. Thank you. Arise Foundation.
Thank you, Mish.
Thank you.
Hi, Sujatha. This is Chris in Philadelphia. Super grateful for you being here today, and my question is about proactive uses of this kind of social technology. Trying to think. Yeah, so have you seen the movie The Woodsman?
I have. It's terrible. I have never seen that movie, and I desperately need to see it. People have been telling me for years that I need to see this movie. So, no, I haven't. I'm sorry.
Okay, no worries. For those who don't know, it's about a child sexual abuser who gets out of prison, played by Kevin Bacon, and just a very sort of intimate portrayal of that side of the story. I'm wondering, what are the causes of, you think, adults, being moved to abuse children sexually? And, what are some proactive things that can be done, you know, if restorative practices is a social technology, a spiritual technology that has really clearly effective results. Like, what? How can that same thinking be applied at earlier stages in a proactive way?
Great question. Yeah, restorative justice really is reactive in a sense, right? Like, we're addressing stuff after the harm has been caused, right? For the most part. That not in the school's context, when we have relationship building, when we have, you know. So for me, prevention is a very, very different set of questions. And we focus quite a bit on, I'm not an expert on prevention for adult behaviors towards children. I think that in the children context, right, and I do a bit of facilitating, we just started facilitating dialogues between children when it's child-on-child sexual harm cases. So for me, there's a lot of like positive, healthy sex education stuff that needs to start really, really early, right, with young people and their responsibilities about their bodies in both directions, and especially with young men, but with boys. Like, you know, we have the whole like good touch, bad touch conversations, or these are the names of your body parts, and this is who's, you know, this is, you decide who touches them, and nobody, you know, nobody should be touching them except for when they're very little, you know, only your parents clean those parts of your body. And I started these conversations with my son when he was teeny tiny, right? Because we know sexual harm can happen to even 2-year-olds and younger, right? So that's a part of that. The biggest part of the prevention work is around that. And I think another part of the work that we need to do, without putting any pressure on any survivors to be outspoken, right, because there's tons of collateral consequences for our lives and our communities when we announce that we're abuse survivors, is that we need a really public sort of movement around the fact that this is so ubiquitous. Because then it becomes less shameful. Shame and secrecy on all sides of this harm are the reasons that it continues, right? So if I, you know, I have friends who have served time for sex offenses and sexual harm against children, and having them be sort of out and in the world about that, you know, it's really critical for us to, and for me to be sitting on stages with them talking about this together, right? We need to air this out and get this out. And so the, to the degree to which like restorative processes, like CIRCLE, for example, just CIRCLE without it resolving a particular conflict or crime, allows us to create spaces in which we start to air this stuff out on all sides. We would love to someday do CIRCLES with folks who are people who've done sexual harm in communities, and to have them talk about these things as well, right? So that's, again, not necessarily proactive. I'm sort of mixing them up. But overall, to me, one of the biggest things that needs to happen is breaking silence. And I say that with a full understanding of the dangerousness for that, both for survivors being pathologized, being, you know, there's this whole hashtag going on Twitter right now called "been raped, never reported." And there's a lot of good reasons why people don't speak up, right? On the side of folks who've done the harm, clearly there are countless reasons why people would never speak up about this is what's happened, this is what I've done. But we need folks to be able to do that, and we need to create safe spaces for folks to do that. Those, particularly those not directly impacted by the harm. So that to me, I'm really curious about this model with COSAs, Circles of Support and Accountability. It's the one model that's been shown to actually reduce recidivism amongst folks who have done sexual harm, which is that instead of the sex offender registry approach, right, which is that we know who's in our neighborhood who's done this, we sort of show up with a casserole and have meetings around that person's dinner table once a week, once a month, however intensively it needs to be done, to check in about what's going on with you and the thoughts that are arising, neighbors, community members, being engaged in someone's journey after they've been released from prison. About sort of any desires that are coming up or questions or concerns, really having a community accountability space where you can share. What would it look like for us to create safe spaces where people can talk about what they're feeling on all sides? I think it would radically reduce the harm that's happening in our world, because again, sexual abuse breeds on secrecy and shame. That is, it is the tools of the entire phenomenon on all sides. Everyone is experiencing shame and secrecy. So, and that's what causes it to grow.
Thank you so much. Fatia is a great name for your child.
Yes.
Hi, my name is Harpreet, I'm calling from San Jose, California. Thank you so much for your incredible, I mean, what an example. It's beautiful. I know you're just living your life, but...
Yeah, I really am.
I know. So I wanted to kind of add a little bit. My dad was just a real asshole, you know, all his life. And at some point I wanted to kill him too. And then I said, well, you know, that's probably drastic. And maybe I'll just pay him back for everything he spent on me and never see him again. And, you know, of course, as life would have it, that didn't quite work out. And, eventually, I think I mellowed over him. I just sort of became, I just put him aside and decided not to think about it. Well, as life would have it, you know, these things never stay buried. Mm-hmm. I ran into another situation, which was, I felt it was much worse, as a betrayal by a friend. I lost my wife, my kids, because of this person's, involvement in my life. And I was so angry that I blew out my liver. And as I understand it, the liver is the seat of anger. So after that thing was over, I had to kind of really sit back and look at everything. And I think one of the things that came to my mind was, you know, this guy did so many bad things to me. There's got to be some reason. What is it? And then this thought popped in my head that, wow, you know, this is some kind of karmic cycle here. You know, maybe I did it. I did him under in a previous lifetime. And in order not to perpetuate the cycle, I need to really start to forgive him or figure out what the hell that means anyway. And so that was, you know, I think that was a starting point for me to say, okay, I got to calm this down. I got to calm this anger down. And eventually, you know, of course, I had a year to do nothing but meditate and look at this as I recovered physically, you know, from a surgery. I got a liver transplant. And so that was, you know, that really changed my whole life. I was so, so, so angry. Mm-hmm. And it was just, you know, but taking that perspective, said, okay, this is obviously a payback for somewhere or something. And, you know, I'm not saying that this applies to everybody, but it definitely helped me make sense out of this and you know, to stop perpetuating that anger and, you know, because I was only harming myself. I realized that the more angry I got, you know, I was the one that was harming myself. And then I ran across this little saying. I don't know if Nelson Mandela said this, but somebody said, you know, being angry is like drinking poison and hoping it's going to kill the other person.
Yes,
so,
I love that. I don't know who's the original source of that, but that's one of my favorites.
Yeah, so I keep reminding myself of that, you know, every time I get, and I can't say that anger still doesn't come up for me, you know, but it's definitely much less. And in fact, a couple of years ago, I've been sort of trying to, you know, be more open on the heart level, and my whole back just kind of seized up, you know, like mm-hmm. Bella was talking about earlier in the beginning of the call. I knew that it had something to do with, you know, I'm stuck somewhere on the heart level because that's exactly where my whole back was. And I went mm-hmm. to the doctors. Nobody could do anything for me. You know, then eventually it just went away. So I guess whatever, you know, being in these kind of conversations has been really, really helpful. You know, I'm kind of new to the service space, Awakened Circle thing. So thank you so much for your sharing. I can't tell you how much these ripples are really helping all of us. And
wonderful.
Thank you kindly.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. It is amazing how the anger can really take a physical toll on us. And I just hope for folks that we'll take really good care of ourselves because we deserve it. And the world needs our resilience and our self-care in everything we do. But I just comment really briefly on this notion of karma And the role karma has played, or understanding karma has played in my own acceptance of the things that have happened in my life. And I say acceptance on a spiritual level, not I don't accept child sexual abuse as an okay thing in the world, right? And it's this very tricky dance where I would never want people to, or myself to, use karma as a way of self-blame, because many people who suffer terrible things, it's a very natural response to say, I had this coming somehow. It's definitely something we do as children when our parents harm us in whatever form, sexual or otherwise. We think somehow it is our fault. And so this understanding of like endless karmic webs is moving beyond notions of blame, but really into understanding the interconnected nature of all of the cause and effect things that occur in the world and our place in that. And so as we explore karma and its relationship to the harms we've suffered in our lifetime, I would just really encourage folks to not allow that to be another way we beat ourselves up for the things that have happened to us, right? I'm not saying that you did that at all. It doesn't sound like you were, but it's just flagging for other folks who may be there in their journey. I just remember. I remember reading in the Courage to Heal workbook early in my 20s, something, and it's written by folks who are not Hindu or Buddhist or don't understand karma, saying, don't ever let anyone tell you that this happened to you because of your karma. And I remember recoiling from that, saying, yeah, but karma is actually helping me understand what this whole massive web of harm might be about in the world. And so we can think about it in a more complex and elevated way. I think it's useful when we're thinking about it simply from a, oh, you must have molested somebody in your past life and you deserve it. That's not helpful. Right? It doesn't help us feel better. It's just more victim blaming. So I just would encourage folks to sort of hold those two truths.
Well, Sujata, I can't thank you enough on behalf of all the callers today. And it's been remarkable how honest you've been sharing and you know, all these different personal experiences. And, you know, if I may, and I hope I don't offend you, but, you know, going into the call, you know, I was going to say, okay, we're going to hear this story, your story, and you were, you know, thinking about what your dad did to you, and I started to, you know, I observed this feeling of, you know, oh, I feel sorry for you, I feel sympathy, and I'm sitting there, and I'm listening about this call, and I'm like, I don't, that feeling kind of went away, and it's not that I don't, you know, feel anything toward what happened to you, but I just hear this strength and this just different person that just comes across, and it's so incredibly inspiring, and it really, I can really feel that you've healed, and I just want to thank you for that, because it's such a powerful thing to see and to observe, and so thank you.
Thank you. Well, the little girl that still lives in me appreciates your feeling, you know, sad and sorrow for what I experienced. And the woman in me today appreciates you seeing my strength and my resilience. So I really appreciate both experiences you had.
Thank you. Well, and to all of our callers, if we could, before we sign off, we're going to take another moment of silence. And, you know, just in this time, sort of have a sense of gratitude. And I think it's all that more appropriate given, you know, Sujata sharing her journey and her emphasis on meditation and mindfulness. And so maybe we can take this as a moment of silence and send out positive healing vibes and thoughts to all around us. Thank you. One of the things we like to do just before we sign off on the call is just kind of take all of the callers off of mute, and that way we can all kind of say a collective thing to Sujata. And so on the count of three, I'm going to take everyone off of mute, and if we could just say a big thank you, I think it would be a nice way to sort of sign off the call. And so one, two, and
thank
three.
Thank you.
So, Sujata, again, thank you. And Preeta, thank you so much. You've done a masterful job today of guiding us through this conversation. We hope all of you can join us next week for our next guest, and hope you all have a wonderful weekend. Thank you.
Thank you.